Session number 10614 rule 4.
Mr. John March, Reel 4. We were talking about your period at Titmoning, officers' POW camp. I wondered how much freedom of movement you had to exercise or to walk.
Well, as I explained yesterday, it was obviously a large hunting lodge, battlemented, overlooking the Salzach. And we had a very large courtyard. And we were enabled quite easily to exercise within this courtyard. And the Germans could control us by visual or being there on the spot. Now, we were not allowed on the back paths around the camp because there may be somewhere we'd slip over with a rope or something and slide down to the... So we did exercise sufficiently. Once we were established there, we got no advent of other officers came in there at all because I think the silly period of the war where nobody was caught. And also at exercise, we had a period of their parole walks. Now, parole walks where an officer had to give an undertaking that they would not attempt to escape. Now, so all that happened was this, we had to go down to this lovely village of Titmoning and over through the fields. And I always remember these lovely, things were very, very fertile there because what happened, you had about 6 months of ice and cold and snow, say, from November to March. And then you got this wonderful period of... floration of all the flowers and the vegetables and things. Quite incredible in a matter of a few months, much more so than this. And the reason was they had a superb manure, which was human excreta, which when we used to go on these parole walks, we smelt these, driven by, not cows, by... Yes, what happened was that when we go on these parole walks, we thoroughly enjoyed them because they had one own... There may be 40, 50, 60, 70 of us, quite often to go on them, and went through the woods and things like this, with only one German officer. He had a gun, but I'm not sure. But we never took advantage of him, and we always came back. And we had a very pleasant, I say, commandant who was encouraged this sort of thing. And I was very, very impressed with, in this village, and in the outskirts of the village, seeing these, what I call scheisen, or shit wagons, you see, they were called, driven by oxen. And no wonder the area was so gloriously fertile. And, of course, it's very, very near, as you know, the Austrian Alps. Incredible area. It was a beautiful area near Salzburg.
And how often would you be allowed out on these parole walks?
Speaking memory again, we did not have many. I think it depended how the Germans or the German commandant was feeling. We had a few, but not many. And I always remember now, I happen to have with me, there's a very, very famous sherry which you can still get, Finlattamäki and Todd's sherry. Now, Todd, of Finlattamäki and Todd, was a prisoner of war with us, you see, and indeed, in the small compartments where we lived, actually he had a bunk, a straw, with a straw palliasse, I think, almost next to me. So whenever we went on these walks, he used to collect frogs, because he's a gourmet, you know. And what used to happen is to come back and these little stoves we made up, you see. And we used to have very good roasted frogs, because he was an expert on frogs. And of course, we all said, pity we hadn't his glorious sherry with us, you see. But there are a few things. And then, of course, this was the time when I first started giving grandpa recitals.
I'll come to that. With exercise, did you have any sport, you know, in the court, where you took your...
No, yes, you probably got a football or something, and you could play with that if you did, but I never bothered. But in this case...
There was no organised...
No, sport. Nothing organised, because we there were a comparatively small and happy camp. It only this slosh only held not many people, really. They had to give accommodation.
Well, so how did you amuse yourself during the day?
Well, it's the old story. What used to happen was we eventually got a lot of books because one of our prisoners of war, I'm not sure, I think he was at Titmoning, but he was certainly the next camp I went to, Elliot Viney of Hazel, Watson and Viney, who are the printers or were the printers of Penguin Books. Indeed, I saw Elliot Viney only a year or two ago in Newcastle. He's still alive. And what happened? His wife, for the duration of the war, spent her time in Lisbon. And she's a very good Red Cross contact with us for the Red Cross parcels, as well as books. So normally, when he was very well supplied with books, And not so much at this camp, but we did have lectures. I was an expert in some chapters.
You had lectures at Titmouse then?
A few, because we had an expert in many subjects. Indeed, people I'm going to tell you about later when I get to Eichstätt, many people took their exams.
What kind of subject would you be lectured on at Titmouse? What sort of
Well, very, very few. I'd rather leave leave that to the next camp, because I remember that more vividly. But we had a fellow, I forget his name now, a fluent French speaker, real character. He spoke French more like than anybody else. He's with the American Express Company in Paris, and he gave little talks. And then we got the odd record through, and I often do the odd recital, because I'm very keen on music. And indeed, I was sent in a letter by my wife. My wife, as you know, or do not know, she died 10 years ago, about 30 years, heart trouble. And she sent me a cutting from the local paper, the Durham County Advertiser, of myself, a drawing which I'd sent home of my giving a recital.
Where did you get the equipment from, the player?
Well, we managed to get it through the Red Cross.
That was at Titmouse?
At Titmouse, yes, but only in a way.
Right. We'll save that again until we get to Ike's.
I think it's better to do that.
Other recreations at Titmouse you can remember to keep you amused?
No, we used to have... I think they used to gamble. We had, as I said, Charlie Hopton was the late Marxist Hopton of Edinburgh, and Peter Doyle, I mentioned about these before. They were keen gamblers, and we used to gamble on anything, you see. We saw a fly or a frog coming along. We'd even though they were bloody worthless, because we couldn't spend anything on them. We could a little bit that time, but later on we couldn't use them at all, because nothing to buy with them, you see. And again, that's the time we started getting through cigarettes. Now, my wife... I always had a taste in good cigarettes. I still have, even though I don't smoke now. I also got Players Number 3. And my wife gave a weekly order to Donkin's, the tobacconist in them, because we knew them very well, and she knew them very well, a weekly order of 200 Players Number 3, which went throughout the war. In point of fact, only half came to me. But they're a magnificent bargaining power, because you'd swap... people would love cigarettes, especially good ones like these, and I could probably swap for a bar of chocolate or swap for some soap, especially the one. But again, I may get 4 or 5 or 6 weeks, then have a gap several weeks after that. But this was continuous, and the same thing with Red Cross parcels. One per person was sent per week, but one never got one per person. That was the ration, and this applied to being a prisoner of war.
What about the daily routine at Titmouse? I mean, you won't remember the detailed times, but how do you spend the day from when you got up in the morning to the end? Do you have any idea, a typical day?
It's very difficult. I suppose we read. We had the odd lecture there, and it was quite a pleasant walking around the camp square and chatting to one another and this sort of thing. And I don't think there were any active games played there, because it wasn't big enough. And there weren't enough officers.
Was there any religious life or services for you at the camp?
Yes, because at Titmouse, and I think the next camp, we had several padres. But as I said before, these non-combatants were soon shifted to the stalags. We needed them. And as I said at the time, all these officers were sent to these camps initially, the officers' camp, but it was quite stupid having about 6 parsons there, or 6 to 3 dentists, when they should be better employed looking after British troops elsewhere. But we all, and being a Catholic, you see, two stick in my mind. One was the famous, he's dead now, lived at Reading Hall, near Harrogate, a very famous house to visit. In fact, when I visited that place a few years ago, was 6 or 7 years ago. My army name was known as Just. We said, Just, what the hell are you doing here? Good God, you own this place, do you? He said, yes, I live here. And his name was, I think the name was Rack, doesn't even matter. Reading Hall, Cardiff. He died. And also, we had another interesting man, Lord Arundel, who was a relative of the Duke of Norfolk and lived at Arundel Castle. And they were very, very keen in Catholics. And we always had the odd parson there, you see, or priest. And what happened was we were able to quite easily to have our services for anybody who wanted to come. And you had Church of England, of course, and probably Church of Scotland people, because bear in mind the 51st Division was Scottish, you see. And then again, at the time, records started coming through. And I remember, I think it was a Tet morning, I must have heard that one of the glories of all operatic music, of course, must be Tristan by Wagner. One of the greatest operas ever written, I think. I'm not the only one. The opera takes about four and a half hours flat to hear. Now, somebody got a set of recordings sent from home. And I remember three or four of the records were cracked. Three or four of the records were cracked, and he had to stick them together, fairly cleverly done. And here we were, a few of us, just spent lapping up 4 hours of Tristan. But once a week or twice a week, I must have heard the thing 50 times. It must be, or not a world record, it can't be a world record, but an amazing record. And this thing, and that's when I started giving a few grand on the side. Not like next camp. I give a lot then. But we did fill our time in reading this, talking, and always talking about being hungry and this sort of thing. And we worried about, of course, news at home. We weren't really organised at Tet morning. Much more that's going to be told to you.
I'll ask you about a bit more about the, you know, the organisation. Did you have any servants, officers' servants there, any other ranks to help you or look after you?
I think at Tet morning, yes, there were a few. And I think they did some help by sweeping out the rooms and things like this. But that was the only time.
Were they British?
Yes, British. They were British. Because I remember this at the time. We had a few at this camp, and they must have been the ones who were, you see, getting to these camps, you know, it was just chaos. They obviously had some ordinary other ranks with us, you see. And it just happened. Some, I'm sure, were at Tet morning, but not at the other camps.
Did you have much contact with them?
Oh, yes, we had contact with them.
Well, did they live in the same conditions as you
did? I think they did. I'm not sure whether they were given a bit more freedom than we were. If they were, we weren't allowed contact with them, because they may have had a little more freedom. But I can't really confirm this. But the word orderlies did little things for us.
Were you allowed to... Did you get any letters, or did you send letters to home during the
period? Letters were sent regularly, and were normally censored. Censored.
How?
By the Germans. By the Germans.
Did you try and conceal messages within them, or did...
Well, no, I'm not sure whether, again, I'm getting mixed up with the camp, but what used to happen was, I used to get my wife, being very, very musical, I asked my wife, would you copy out the concert, which were paid, shall we say, in the Sunday Times. I'm not sure which the paper was. And, of course, I got picked the ones that might suit me, you see, and she gave me a list of all these concert performances, and the conductors, and the orchestras, and the works they were performing, you see. And eventually... Now, this could have been at the Eichstätt camp or the one I was at Tet morning. Eventually, I had to write and tell her this had to be stopped because the Germans were quite afraid that there's some coding, some code, which is not the case at all. And bear in mind, whereas Germany is the most musical nation in the world, with people like Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, and Wagner to begin with, the most musical nation in the world, they did feel that where England's always known as a land of music, and not so much now, and they felt there was going to be there could be a code coming through for my wife. So, and sadly, that had to be stopped.
I presume you didn't have to work at all for the Germans?
We were not allowed to, no. The Geneva Convention, we never allowed worked at all. You probably kept your structures sort of tidy and this sort of thing tidy.
Now, you mentioned you didn't have much organisation.
Didn't.
Did you have a senior officer or anything
yes.
like that?
Yes, that again... I'm not sure who he was. See, the senior officer there was General Fortune. As I say, he was of Scottish extraction, so was his ADC, another charming Scotsman, you see. And they really didn't get involved very much because they had little room on their own, you see. But it really was quite a small camp. We knew everybody. But we didn't really get organised for senior British officers until we entered the next camp, where there were 2,000 officers.
So you didn't have an escape committee or anything like that at Tet morning?
No, because, as I know, no escaping was attempted. We weren't organised with collecting food and this sort of thing, and being there long enough to use Red Cross parcels and mix chocolate up with oats and things like this. And it was very difficult to get out of this place. It's on a hill, huge, deep hillside, and it's very hard to get down there, get out of the camp.
How did you get on with your fellow POWs there? Was there any stress being cooped up together? And
I never came across it. But some people, obviously under tremendous stress, because there are many, many cases, you see, just assume cases where when they were captured, their wives may have been very ill, or children were about to be born, and lack of real contact with their families did create that stress in that respect.
But it didn't come out...
Not really. It affected them, because when they got home, many people said there were different people altogether when they got home. Some had been affected. I don't think I've been affected at all. In fact, I'm sure I'd better be in prison. I've always said this. But you learn how to live under conditions which are not normal, and you could get nothing but good from that.
How did you get on with the German guards and the commandant and Antip moaning?
Well, they were all right, because we weren't involved with them very much. They counted us twice a day. We had to line up in fives. You could only count in fives. And as I say, the commandant there was von somebody. He was a real German gentleman. And he respected us, and we respected him. So really, there's no problem at all, because we really hadn't started... I don't think we started escaping there, even. Because we weren't there long enough. We were the overflow, you see, from Laufen. And by this time, they got themselves organised. Then we had to go to Eichstätt next to it.
How long in months do you think you were at Titmoning? Would you say at a guess? Was it a year or...?
A year would be a guesstimate. Yes, about a year.
So you probably went to Eichstätt round about late 41 or early 42?
42. The war finished in 45, didn't it? Yes, 45. The war finished in 45. Probably, this was 1940, 41, early 42, yes, I think you're probably right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how did you first hear of the transfer, that you were being transferred, or that the camp was being...
Well, I mean, what happens, the German commandant gets in touch with whoever the senior British officer was, just says, we're moving you to camp at such a date. And all contact with the Germans was done through the senior British officer. Now, I'm not sure whether General Fortune was involved. I think he kept him out of it. So I can't recall who our senior British officer was. And Laufen, I say nothing about. We were only there a few days. I don't think we really sufficiently... We're all very friendly lot, you know, there. And a few number of us. And, of course, I think we joined another company.
So you made the move. Was there anything at the move to Eichstätt?
Well, before I mentioned... No. Not really. I think we went by cattle trucks. But it was quite a short journey, because we were, ferrying near Salzburg. And Eichstätt is near Ingolstadt and Nuremberg and places like this. It's ferry near Munich.
And what was it? This was, you mentioned this was a much bigger camp.
The layout of the camp was, Eichstätt, of course, is a very, very famous place. It's a beautiful town, little city. And it has years of German history. I think it was a very, very ecclesiastical town as well. And it was on the river Altmühl, I think. Altmuel. Altmühl. And I remember I used to break my heart, because only about 50, 60 months I wrote the Great Wagnerian Festival. But anyway, how I know there was, it was a static camp for 2 or 3 years. And I always remember the SBO was a Welsh Guardsman, Lieutenant Colonel Summary. I think people above Colonel Brigadiers. They, if there were any, they were pushed off to another camp. Like we had a time, I think we had with us that great music lover, Earl of Harwood, a very, very great music lover. And I think he was for a very, very short time. But he, like certain people connected with Roger, high-ranking army officers, were put at other camps.
And what did the camp look like? I mean, it wasn't a castle camp.
No, it wasn't. It was a camp, again, we're near the river Odmühl. I can't remember now. It's a most lovely city with castles, churches, lovely
buildings.
But
the camp, what was the
layout? Camp. I'm trying to think what the camp was like. It was... it must have been some building or buildings belonging to some institution. That's it, the one side of it. The opposite side, of course, was the river Altmühl, I think Altmuel, M-U-L, I think. And the other ends, of course, were open, but just barbed wire to get out of. Yes, but there we were there for 2,000, there were 2,000 British officers there, approximately.
The defences were barbed wire fences?
Yeah, all barbed wire fences.
And what was the what was your accommodation? What type of building?
Again, in huts. We were, where we were mainly, we were with in purpose-built huts. But many of the older buildings, which was up on a slight hill, one whole side, were some institute or some building or some whatever it was, rooms and buildings, whereas we were in one end, down below, purpose-built.
And this camp was much more organised, you say, with the...
Oh, yes, we got ourselves much more organised. We had to, yes.
Now, what do you remember of the sort of conditions at the camp? Conditions that you lived under?
Well, in a way, you know, they're quite exciting. Because, of the, as I've said before, food was coming a little more regularly.
You mean the Red Cross parcels?
Red Cross parcels, by the Red Cross parcels, you see.
And what kind of thing would you get in the parcels?
Oh, you used to always get tins of butter, tea, biscuits, and fish. The usual iron rations, corned beef. And what used to happen with these parcels, they used to come in, but there was never one per officer. Now, what happened, some of the British officers organised... Presumably, if so many came in, we'd be given a proportion. Or if they collected them, they may wait till we got one each. Now, what happened then was you had to go to the little German place. We couldn't just get the parcel. We weren't allowed to give them the parcel because there may be escaping equipment in there. There may be some escaping equipment there. So what happened? We had to turn up in due course, and if we want a tin of Spam or a tin of corned beef or a tin of butter or some tea, the Germans opened the tins just to make quite sure there's nothing in them. And if there's tea or soap, they'll examine them in case there's something concealed. So you had that sort of, like the correspondence, I'm trying to think of the word when they... anything came in was examined by the general before being passed away. But I think the system, organising system, was done by the SBO, senior British officer, and presumed it. And it was done with this through the Germans' aid. We had to call it. It was done. And... But it came through fairly regularly. Books we got through fairly, because I mentioned before that we had Elliot Viney with us here, whose firm, Hazel Watson Viney, printed the Penguin books, and his wife being in the war in Portugal. We got a good selection of books, which led to...
Where were they kept?
I think we had... Well, there was some sort of hall here, because I remember... Yes, because... some hall, because when I used to give grandpa recitals there, about 300 or 400 people there, and it was in one of these buildings, you see. I don't know what the building was. I mean, sadly, like I think many of my friends would say the same thing, because of the war, that if you only knew, realised that you'd be getting out of here in due course, in 20 or 30 years' time, getting asked a lot of questions, we'd have made sure we had some written information and pictures and things like this and drawings. But sadly, we never think of these. I can't tell you, but I say part of this camp were fixed buildings built there over centuries ago. And then you had other purpose-built buildings. For instance, what we had was we soon made a small pitch, which we used to play five-a-side hockey on. We couldn't play a full-side because we couldn't make a full-side hockey pitch. It wasn't big enough. And then, of course, in the winter months, which was from December to March or April, we would flood this. And we skated there. Now, I don't know, I'm not sure, it's very quite small. We built it ourselves flat, you see, just at the far side of the main buildings of the camp, and next to the river. And so we had ice hockey, and ice hockey in the winter months. And this looks very, very exciting, but I can show you it wasn't. But it kept us occupied, and it was bloody cold, by the way. Very cold indeed, because I remember, fortunately, my wife, and of course some other wives, they were able to send me, quite legally, she was able to buy a pair of RAF lamb's wool boots. They were bloody well marvellous. I'd sleep in them, wear them, but we quite legally could buy these and get them sent out. And so it was very, very cold, but very healthy.
Was there any heating in the huts?
Yes, of some sort, wooden, things like this, but again, we'd find bits of wood and put in, this sort of thing. We didn't dare chop trees down, wood and stuff like this. And we did, well, there was, but normally you were always cold. At night time, as I say, we were in a place, we had bunks, about eight or nine of us in one little room. And we had bunks of three. And in point of fact, with us, there were about four British and about six Australians. And that reminds me, at this camp, we also had a miniature sports pitch. Where, in point of fact, the Brits played the Australian cricket. Because in the little crowd I was with, I think we had one or two Australian state cricketers. I mean, cricketers were jolly good. Some fast bowlers are jolly good. And again, and then we had cricket and soccer. And even baseball when the Canadians came. Because the Canadians from the there, we'd have baseball. But you may think, it doesn't sound half as good as it was. The very, very small conditions. And I always remember the story. Now, we had with us a David Brims, who's in the Thumb Fusiliers, an absolute gentleman. He's a well-known builder in Newcastle, most charming man you can meet anywhere, a very fine, slow bowler. He used to bowl for Northern County for years. And he, of course, is one of the star bowlers when we Brits had to play against the Australians, you see, fast bowlers. And, of course, David Brims has been such a gentleman. He used to say, Jasper, I never appeal when I'm bowling unless I'm certain the batsman is out. Now, those bloody Australians calling us pommy bastards, they appeal for everything. And that was the difference between them and us. And it's still the case today, which happened then. And after all, the Australian, very pleasant and cultured, they've got an inferiority complex, you know. They've only been established for a few hundred years, where we've got this history. And they felt this, you could see this, they felt this and smelt this. But, and then we get on to enjoying ourselves. Well, you see, I can't remember now, but it was David Brims who told me, because he's dead now, I used to see him quite occasionally, that at our camp, we had there, among the officers, bear in mind, 2,000, four, five, or six, who turned out to be cabinet ministers in the Tory party. Now, I know I'm going to be asked, but I can't tell you. I can't remember who they were. I think one was Jim Prine, people like this. And you had very well-known people there, experts in almost every subject. Because what used to happen, realizing the war was going to be on for year after years, we were able to, there were many colleagues of mine, shall we say, in banks and insurance camp solicitors, who thought, why can't they study for their exams? As it happened, I'd already had my exam in the Institute of Bankers, and arrangements were made